From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to the Tuesday edition of Washington Watch. I am Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony Perkins today and for the remainder of your week. Idaho's Republican Governor Brad Little vowed Friday that his state would not pay for gender reassignment surgery for a convicted sex offender, a biological male. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled the state was responsible for providing $20,000 to $30,000 worth of gender reassignment surgery. In just a moment, I'll talk with Doreen Denny, the Senior Director of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, about why she agrees with the Idaho governor that taxpayers should not be compelled to pay for optional, medically inappropriate surgeries. In my second segment, the Eighth Circuit recently ruled that two Christian videographers are legally allowed to turn down filming a gay wedding, which violated their religious convictions despite the Minnesota State Court's ruling. I'll talk with Alliance Defending Freedom attorney Jake Warner on ADF's win. At the bottom of the hour, if you want to see more Christians in elected office on all levels, then the key is to get more like-minded, Bible-believing people registered to vote. My Faith Votes is urging your church to participate in voter registration Sunday on September 22nd. I'll talk with Audrea Decker, their director, about the initiative. And at 42 past the hour, a John Jay College professor was put on administrative leave last year for his activities with anarchist network Antifa. But now, the Daily Signal reports he's no longer working for the college at all. Are professors like this more common than you think? I'll talk with Shelby Talcott of the Daily Signal. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com, today's podcast website, for more information, including a publication directly relevant to our second segment. Follow Tony on Twitter at TPerkins or me, if you'd care to, at Sarah P. Perry. We've got lots to talk about, so let's get to it. The Ninth Circuit is called the Nutty Ninth by some people in the legal community for a reason. And recently, Idaho's Republican Governor Brad Little is vowing that his state won't pay for gender reassignment surgery for a convicted sex offender, a biological male, after the Ninth Circuit ruled that the state was responsible for providing the $20,000 to $30,000 procedure. Listen to the reaction from Crystal Johnson, a Meridian, Idaho resident, when asked what she was thinking by the local TV affiliate. Let's listen.
I don't believe that anyone should be getting special privileges, especially someone who is in there for crimes against children. There's not much moral fiber in saying, hey, here you go, commit a crime, and we'll give you whatever you want. He can top out his time in 2021, and at that time, save up the money for a surgery just like everybody else.
I agree, and I have a suspicion that probably my next guest does as well. Joining me with her analysis is Doreen Denny, Senior Director of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, the nation's largest public policy women's organization, in addition to appearing on Fox, PBS NewsHour, CBN, and National Public Radio. Her work has been featured in The Washington Times, The Daily Signal, and The Hill. She is a Master of Public Policy from the Harvard Kennedy School and resides with her husband in Arlington, Virginia. Doreen, welcome to Washington Watch.
Well, it's wonderful to be with you, Sarah. Thank you so much for having me.
Doreen, you all at CWA have done wonderful coalition building and efforts on this gender identity notion. So perhaps you are as incensed as I am that the Ninth Circuit, who we know tends to be an outlier on jurisprudence, decided that the taxpayers had to, in fact, reach into their pockets and pay for $30,000 gender-affirming surgery. Now, I want our listeners to make note of the fact that Andre Edmo is serving a 10-year sentence for sexually abusing a 15-year-old boy. He's been pretending to be a woman and now wants to get taxpayer-funded surgery. So he looks more like the female he believes he is. This is wrong on so many levels. I barely know where we start.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more, Sarah. And of course, as you said, it's not really a surprise out of the Ninth Circuit, but what we're seeing are activist judges who are imposing a very aggressive view and an activist view about transgenders on the rest of America and asking us to pay for it as well. And what's particularly disconcerting in this case is you do have a registered, well, I don't say it's registered, you have a sex offender in prison serving a sentence for sexual assault against an individual, a minor. And for somehow they think that this male person transitioning to a female and then possibly put in a female prison is not going to have these issues any longer. In fact, we've seen around in other cases quite the opposite. You had Karen White in the United Kingdom, who was a male transitioned to female, was in for sex offenses and rape, was put from the male prison to the female prison, and then proceeded to rape female inmates. This is the kind of problem that we have when we're not only considering bowing to the, you know, gender notions of a particular person, but specifically a person who's imprisoned for crimes against others that are sexual in nature. So that's, you know, the thing that we need to be worried about is not just the fact that we would have taxpayers paying for the surgery, but the fact that even in doing so, it could lead to further consequences about where they're housed, where they're located, the access that they have to other female prisoners who don't have an ability to be free themselves, and the kind of consequences that could come as a result of that.
Absolutely. This really is the Pandora's box. If we start paying for elective surgeries on which the science does not support their necessity, as we know this comes from an underlying internal belief as opposed to a biological, physiological illness, we start here in prison. And naturally, this is a domino effect, a potential domino effect, which is our concern as much as yours. Now, we know he was diagnosed with gender dysphoria, so this is a condition that causes him distress. He did attempt to castrate himself twice in prison. He clearly has deep-rooted mental issues. However, I don't think that elevates this procedure to the level of medically necessary. Do you?
Well, in fact, we've learned from others who've had gender dysphoria and have had treatment for it. It doesn't solve their problems, you know.
No.
So even if the surgery to remove a healthy body part would then somehow, you know, help to mitigate some of these deep-seated dysphoric feelings, that doesn't mean that the person is going to be rehabilitated from their deeper issues. And so, you know, doing that kind of thing is really not getting at the deep root of the problem. And certainly the fact that this person's a sex offender, I mean, rehabilitation for sex offenses, that's a better use of that money to start out with. I mean, again, we don't know that this is going to help solve the underlying issues. It could further mask the underlying issues, and that in and of itself is even a worse use of taxpayer funds.
Right.
So, you know, here we have a situation where there is now going a split in the courts. I mean, the Ninth Circuit's the outlier. The First and the Fifth Circuit courts have ruled the other way. This is a prime case that should go to the Supreme Court. I hope that they would hear it or send back, you know, based on other courts and rulings, the fact that this is completely erroneous. Again, I do agree that this person has problems. I'm sorry for that. But the person is also an inmate in jail and needs to be treated in that case as a prisoner. And that's, you know, we would hope that there would be other means for rehabilitation for the underlying offenses that the person serving his time for, instead of doing things that are not going to help the situation in the long run.
I actually want to support that with the fact here that a prison doctor who was treating this individual, Mr. Edmo, actually rejected his request for surgery, saying that the method of treatment was medically unnecessary, which to me, again, raises the specter of what an outlier the Ninth Circuit is, because they are willing to ignore, in this case, direct medical evidence of the fact that this was not something that needed to be done for this inmate, and I find their institution, their representation that this is a violation of the Constitution's Eighth Amendment prohibition against cruel and unusual punishment to be really straining. They said that the prison officials were deliberately indifferent to his gender dysphoria. Well, you can be deliberately indifferent to someone's request for a second hamburger. It doesn't rise to the level of legally justiciable action. So I really think the whole decision, the whole ruling is just fraught with holes.
Well, and I have to, you know, you have to give credit to the Idaho governor. I mean, when he came into office, he said that he was going to work to get this district court opinion overturned. I mean, what the Ninth Circuit did was actually affirm a lower court ruling. They didn't make the opposite judgment. They just continued the same judgment. It does put a burden on the taxpayers of the state of Idaho, but it also sets a very dangerous precedent across the country. This would be the first time in this kind of a case where an inmate was given sex reassignment surgery paid for by the taxpayers because that person is under the jurisdiction of the federal court, of the court system. I mean, that's the reason that this is not elective, even if it could be surgically, even deemed surgically necessary. It wouldn't come out of the inmate's pocket. It would come out of the court's pocket or the judicial system's pocket. And that, yes, of course, is funded by the American taxpayer. So that's, you know, it's kind of a double injustice in that regard for the people that are looking to have their taxpayer money spent on things that really are medically necessary, medically improving, that are healthy in nature. I mean, amputating a person's body parts is not healthy if it's unnecessary. And I think that was part of what the court physician was saying, was that it's not medically necessary, and in fact could create further complications for this particular person just from a health standpoint.
Well, in the minute we have left here, Republican Governor Brad Little, who you did mention, is already indicating that they are planning on heading to the Supreme Court, which, based on the fact that we have a complete split now among the circuits, it looks like it's perfectly set up for a constitutional challenge to go to the Supreme Court. And he said, we cannot divert critical public dollars away from higher priorities of keeping the public safe and rehabilitating offenders, which, as you noted, ought to be a bigger priority. We really need more elected officers like this, don't we?
We do. And to understand, for him to say rehabilitating offenders, it needs to be a priority, is an important statement. I mean, we don't put people in jail just to let them buy time and think, you know, release them into society again and think that they're going to be a better person. I mean, they do need to be rehabilitated. And that's what needs to happen in this case. In this case, this is a sex offender that needs rehabilitation from sex offenses. And that's where the priority ought to be. That person also has deeper issues that need to be medically or, you know, psychologically treated. But again, sex reassignment surgery is not going to be the answer.
No, you are better off spending your $30,000 elsewhere. Doreen Denny, Senior Director of Government Relations for Concerned Women for America, such a great guest. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, the Eighth Circuit has issued a win for Christian videographers who are now allowed to turn down filming a gay wedding. I'll talk with ADF attorney Jake Warner coming up next.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. end birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday to you.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at Family Research Council, filling in for Tony Perkins. And we have a good news segment, which I always love and I hope encourages you. The Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Carl and Angel Larson, a married couple and the clients of Alliance Defending Freedom, when it upheld the right of these two videographers in Minnesota to turn down requests for filming a gay wedding as a basis for violation of their religious convictions. Joining me now with his analysis is ADF attorney Jake Warner. Jake, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so the case is Telescope Media Group versus Lucero, and it must be said before we start the segment here that David Strauss, who was nominated by Trump and confirmed back in January of 2018, wrote the majority opinion, and this was a split decision. It was 2-1, and it reinstated free speech and free exercise of religion claims after the lower court had dismissed them. So this is good to see and further proof that we need good judicial nominees, how important these courts are. So before we get into the specifics of this case, tell me a little bit about Carl and Angel Larson. They had a videography business where they did film weddings, but they also have 8 children. So give me a little background on what they believe.
Well, Carl and Angel Larson own Telescope Media Group, a Minnesota filmmaking company. They serve everyone. They just can't create films that express every message. As part of their work, they want to create wedding films that promote their religious beliefs about marriage. But according to Minnesota officials, if the Larsons create films celebrating marriage between one man and one woman, they must also create films promoting different views about marriage, which violate their beliefs, including films promoting same-sex marriage. And like you said on Friday, on appeal, the court rejected that view and affirmed that the Larsons have the right to live and work consistent with their beliefs, consistent with their deepest beliefs, without fear of government punishment. And that's a big win for everyone.
Yes, it absolutely is. In fact, if I have to sort of pick out the issue that stands clearly to me, it is not just the importance of these cases involving specifically free exercise of religion or freedom of speech. But I also want to know in what universe we have gotten to the point with these judges, activist judges, and other circuits at which the rights to a wedding cake somehow supersede those of free speech and free exercise of religion. And again, here I am faced with a shocking notion of what a court is willing to extend as the basis for what they interpret to be rational jurisprudence, when in fact it seems outright clear to me, and perhaps to you guys as well, that free speech and free exercise of religion, those claims ought to move forward. Those are constitutionally guaranteed rights. So these Minnesota officials warned that if they declined to film this gay wedding, the Larsons would face substantial fines. It seems to me we have been in a situation like this before. Is that the case?
Well, certainly we've seen a number of cases like the Larsons pop up around the country. You think of Jack Phillips, the Colorado cake artist, and Bernal Stutzman, the Washington florist. Thankfully, this court, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, got it right. The same principle that protects the Larsons, the same principle that the Eighth Circuit just announced on Friday, protects people like Jack and Bernal the same as the Larsons. And this decision gives a roadmap for other courts on how the First Amendment should interact with these public accommodation laws.
And the Eighth Circuit ultimately agreed that the government should never have the power to force anyone to celebrate events or express messages. And it was really this compulsion to express a contradictory message. And those of us who hold beliefs that are important to us, that are part of the fabric of who we are as individuals, to force those to be violated for the sake of provision of a service. And I loved the fact that the judge drew into it an analogous example of, for example, a Muslim tattoo artist being forced to tattoo on a Christian, "My God is the only God." So there really are numerous effects. I mean, the judge talked a little bit about how the logical extrapolation of anything other than their free exercise and free speech claims really opens up a bit of, as we talked about in the last segment, Pandora's box, doesn't it?
That's right. The principle that protects the Larsons is the same principle that protects everyone, even those who disagree with the Larsons on the issue of marriage or any other issues. Creative professionals don't surrender their freedom of speech just because they enter the marketplace. And another example that the Eighth Circuit highlighted in its opinion on Friday was, hey, should the government have the power to punish a Democratic speechwriter, for example, for not writing speeches promoting the Republican Party? Of course not. The government does not have that power, and that's a good thing, not only for the Larsons, but for everyone, especially those who disagree with them.
I love the fact that this truly is about protecting the freedom of speech as expressed in an artistic format, because it's such a unique skill set. As we've talked about in the past with Bernal and the flowers, and we've talked about Jack as well and the cakes, this is yet another aspect in which someone uses their talents to express a particular message and to force someone to express a contradictory message to their beliefs really should be a matter of settled law. Were you surprised in this last minute we have left to see such a good outcome from the Eighth Circuit?
Well, I'd say that we're pleased. We're very excited that the Eighth Circuit saw what we saw all along, that the Constitution protects the expressive decisions of U.S. citizens, that government has no power to force people to express messages that violate their core beliefs. And like I said, that is the same principle that not only protects the Larsons, but protects everyone, including those who disagree with them. We're excited. We're very thankful that the Eighth Circuit recognized and upheld that fundamental principle.
Jake Warner, an attorney with Alliance Defending Freedom, who's been my guest on a great decision out of the Eighth Circuit. Check out FRC's publication, Religious Liberty and the Wedding Vendor, at TonyPerkins.com for a paper that we've authored on precisely this issue. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins the remainder of the week. Coming up next, why Christians need to register to vote and what one organization is doing to ensure it happens. Coming up next.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships here at FRC, filling in for Tony Perkins. Well, out of America's 90 million Christians, as many as 40 million do not vote in presidential elections. 15 million are not even registered. If you want to see more Christians and conservatives holding elective office on local, state, and national levels, then you have to get people who are like-minded out to vote. My Faith Votes is a nonpartisan movement that motivates, equips, and activates Christians in America. And they're urging your church to participate in voter registration Sunday, this coming September 22nd. Joining me now is Audria Decker with My Faith Votes. Audria, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be with you.
Now, I know that the first question that comes to mind of many of the listeners is probably simple, which is there any legal prohibition against churches hosting a voter registration event on church property? I can imagine liberal heads exploding, screaming, oh, no, this is a violation of the separation of church and state. You can't do this. What's the answer to that?
That's right. It's one of the most frequently asked questions that we get. And we talk about the legal do's and don'ts for churches. And really, it's fairly simple. Churches are not permitted to endorse a candidate, but they are more than able to host a voter registration drive and encourage their church members to bring biblical values out into the public square and into the voting booth. And one of the things that we have done for people is created a really simple guide that has all the legal do's and don'ts for church leadership to know exactly what they can do in their church, and people can access that at voterregistrationsunday.org because, like you said, it's one of the most common questions.
So are there directions there about how they can contact state officials? Because once people register, I think the entire process to them might seem terribly overwhelming. If you're not like us here at FRC following policy and politics on a daily basis, is there a bit of a guide to show people what to do after they register? How do they get, for example, their voter cards?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we have put together a toolkit at voterregistrationsunday.org. And there's really two things there. The first is to make sure that you yourself are an equipped voter. And the second is tools for you to help equip other people to vote. And one of the things that is unique about My Faith Votes and unique about Voter Registration Sunday is that we have some really fantastic technology that helps people register to vote, request their absentee ballots, locate their polling place, and provides them reminders for every single election. We know that in 2019 alone, there's over 70,000 elections taking place across the country from the local level, across states, and of course to the federal level as well. And so we want to make sure that people don't miss those opportunities. We don't just vote every 2 years, but we're voting every year, and especially at the local level where we have tremendous influence to bring the values of our faith to our communities. And we don't want to miss those opportunities.
I was absolutely flabbergasted when I read that as many as 40 million don't vote in presidential elections and 15 million are not even registered in the first place. This has got to be an encouraging reason for you to get up and do what you do every morning, because that is a huge segment of the population.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Barna Research in 2016 found that that's about 4 out of every 10 people at your church that are not voting. And really, when we look at the issues today, the sanctity of life, marriage and family, religious freedom, care and compassion for those in need, I mean, these are just some of the things that we talk about at My Faith Votes. But we need to be participating in the conversation and bringing the solutions of our faith to our communities. And we talk about that this is ways that we can love and serve our neighbor. We have incredible influence as people of faith to really live out our faith authentically in the political process. And so we believe that every church in America, 100% of every church congregation should be registered to vote. And that's why we launched Voter Registration Sunday. And anyone can participate. We're encouraging people on September 22nd to participate. But if your church can't do that day, pick another day and host a voter registration drive and make sure that people in your church are engaged.
I love what your CEO, Jason Yates, who is the CEO of Faith Vote, said. He said the local church is key to helping every Christian understand how important it is to influence the culture and nation through one's faith. And one of the most crucial ways to do that is by voting with biblical values. Your organization does such tremendous good work. We encourage you, our listeners here to Washington Watch, to go to myfaithvotes.com and voterregistrationsunday.org. Do I have those websites right, Andrea?
You do. Thank you. Yep, voterregistrationsunday.org.
You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting here for Tony Perkins on this Tuesday edition. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. As a reminder, go there for resources and links and further information, including FRC's publication on wedding vendor cases and religious liberty implications. Well, coming up next, a fascinating story and perhaps one that's disheartening to those of you with kids headed to college. A college professor resigned after admitting support for the anarchist group Antifa. I'll talk with Shelby Talcott, a reporter with the Daily Caller, coming up next on Washington Watch.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org/engage.
radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, president of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, Luana, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the garden tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry. I'm sitting in for Tony Perkins today. TonyPerkins.com is our podcast website. Well, this particular story strikes me as compelling, because I have a personal interest in where my children will be, or where we hope they will be 5 years ago or 5 years from now. If the Lord tarries, we would like to have them in college. We've told them that college is simply cost of entry, that college is a requirement, but what they do after that will be subject to where they feel the Lord's leading them. But college first. So it strikes me as particularly disheartening that we are seeing what appears to be a trend at colleges and universities coast to coast. And my next guest is here to talk about one particular individual who has been swept up in this trend, a Kirkwood Community College professor in Iowa. He has resigned after confirming that he supports Antifa following ridiculous social media posts coming to light. Joining me now with her analysis is Shelby Talcott. She was a journalism major. She's a former student athlete from the University of Iowa, played professional tennis for 4 years following college, and she is now reporting for the Daily Caller, in which this story appeared. And she has more to say on this topic. Shelby, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, okay, Antifa. We understand that Antifa is not specifically an organization, but rather a loose network of organizations or individual groups that are set about with this notion of breaking fascism, hence the name Antifa. Although I will say some people like Dan Bongino have referred to Antifa as anti-First Amendment, so that'll certainly get in the craw of anybody who's listening and happens to be affiliated with anarchy and Antifa. But President Trump tweeted that Antifa is comprised of, quote, gutless, radical, left whack jobs who go around hitting only non-fighters, people, over the head with baseball bats, end quote. So before we talk about this particular professor's reaction to Trump's tweet, tell us a little bit more about Antifa. What else do we know about them? And really, what was the organization's genesis?
So the organization began, actually, it was a little bit more popular overseas until President Donald Trump was elected. And once he was elected, I'm sure many of you guys listening have heard of the Charlottesville riots, and that was probably one of the first events that really put Antifa on the map in the U.S. So a lot of people have called them counter-protesters, but they've had a lot of experience with violence, and they've kind of turned into a group that started out as going after who they deemed to be Nazis and extremists, and now they have gone after just sometimes even just people who have general conservative views.
Okay, so tell us particularly what happened in this situation with Jeff Klinsman, who is the former English literature professor at this Kirkwood Community College. Tell us a little bit about how he responded to the tweet and essentially what happened after that.
Yeah, so the tweet was featured on Iowa Antifa's Facebook page, and he replied to Trump's tweet saying, yeah, I know who I'd clock with a bat. Presumably that was directed at the president. And after these comments came to light, reporters asked him to comment on whether he is affiliated with Antifa, and he said, I affirm that I am Antifa. And he added in an email that he doesn't regret anything he's posted online. And the posts have gone, they're pro-Antifa posts, and they're also posts about, you know, he's anti-evangelical Christians. He said that their people fills me with rage and a desire to exact revenge. And following the post coming to light and him affirming that he was Antifa, he resigned Friday, according to Kirkwood Community College.
Okay, so actually, without being driven out, he was put on administrative leave September 15th of last year, but it looks like he just decided that maybe there was too much pressure and he was going to resign on his own, right?
Yeah, so the statement from Kirkwood didn't specifically say that he was pushed out, but they did say, when the expression of views by him or any member of our community is perceived as placing public safety in jeopardy or hampers our ability to deliver on our mission, we'll do what is necessary in service to our students' pursuit of a higher education. So that suggests that maybe he did probably speak to, you know, the higher-ups at Kirkwood, but that's not confirmed.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about that notion of threats of violence or intimidation. And that doesn't actually spring out of the void, but actually arises from federal criminal law, which has a provision that applies directly to what Antifa is apparently doing. And this, I think, is the motivation for why individuals like Representative Jim Banks, Senator Ted Cruz, President Trump himself, have all called for a federal investigation into the operations behind Antifa, because I think for a lot of people, and I know, Shelby, you were watching this as well, the situation out in Portland, Oregon, and what happened to journalist Andy Ngo, I think has a lot of us thinking, okay, enough is enough. So when people automatically avow that they are with an organization that engages in behavior like this, it is above and beyond a level of freedom of speech. So this federal criminal law, 18 U.S.C. Section 241, prohibits conspiracies to, quote, injure, oppress, threaten or intimidate any person in the exercise or enjoyment of any right or privilege secured by the Constitution or laws of the United States, and prohibits individuals, quote, in disguise on the highway or premises of another with intent to prevent or hinder his free exercise or enjoyment of any right, and actually got its start, and I know we're a bit in the weeds, but hang with me, in a 1951 University of Pennsylvania Law Review article, the in disguise language actually began It had the origins in the doings of the KKK, in which individuals were masking their identities to enact criminal activities, criminal behavior, trespass, harassment, assault. Antifa seems to really have adopted the KKK tactics, haven't they? I mean, this is like the same operational system, the same paradigm, just fast forwarded and on the very, very far left, aren't they?
Yeah, so a lot of people have actually called for Antifa to not be allowed to mask themselves, because if you have stayed up on the Andy Ngo attack in Portland, June 29th, that they haven't arrested anyone, and that could be because some of his attackers were masked, which makes it really difficult to figure out exactly who's responsible. But President Trump has supported labeling Antifa as a domestic terrorism group, as have numerous other lawmakers. You know, freedom of speech isn't unlimited. You can say whatever you want, but when you're inciting violence, there is a line that's drawn.
So, yes, let's talk about that argument between free speech and the argument of limitations on speech, public health, public safety, and what criminal law says in the United States. And Antifa screams free speech, and yet, and as I talked to the colleague about this, he brought up this very salient point. Antifa demands something that they are unwilling to tolerate themselves, and that is the notion of free speech. In fact, we might argue that if this professor, Mike Isaacson, was still employed, his employment perhaps might require the same thing, right? So he is aligned with an organization that douses milkshakes, pelts with cement or rocks or stones or backpacks or what have you. And yet, the same free speech that he demands is the same free speech he will not permit. I mean, do other people see the hypocrisy of this operation of Antifa overall?
Yeah, I think for sure this is something that's been discussed a lot among many people. And it's really interesting that they talk about free speech all the time and they promote free speech, but at the same time, anyone who says anything that they don't agree with, it's an automatic kind of attack. Now, granted, of course, this isn't each and every single person in Antifa, but there is a large enough group who are willing to just respond violently because somebody has a different set of beliefs than them. So seems like a kind of one-sided view of freedom of speech, in my opinion.
It certainly does, and it does to us here at Family Research Council as well. I want to talk a little bit about the educational element here, because I opened up this segment by talking about my concern based on the fact that my children are eventually headed to college, and I have a high schooler now for whom we are starting to talk about these kinds of decisions. This seems to be particularly endemic to American higher education. We have Mike Isaacson, who is this Antifa professor at John Jay College. We have this Jeff Klinsman, an Antifa professor at Kirkwood Community College. We have Antifa-associated professors at, for example, UNC Chapel Hill, which a lot of people think about North Carolina. They don't automatically think it's a hotbed of anti-fascist activity, but cultural anthropology professor, a man named Dwayne Dixon, assaulted an editor at Big League Politics and calls himself leader of the left-wing Redneck Revolt militia group, which drew Antifa militants around the region when Big League Politics was reporting on the Silent Sam statue to commemorate North Carolinians who died fighting for the Confederacy. And then Elon University, another affiliate of Antifa, someone who not only sympathizes but who supports their mission, has developed a database of 400,000 suspected far-right activists that she uses to farm out to liberal organizations to dox these individuals. 400,000 that she has made a software to keep tabs on, people she suspects of being on the far right. So these are individuals who are beyond stirring the pot in discourse. If they are not overtly out enacting violent criminal acts, calling for criminal acts, they are working with other individuals to intimidate, threat, and harass directly in violation of federal law. So what's this pull in higher education? As somebody who's a millennial, who is a not too terribly long ago removed from the University of Iowa herself as a graduate, what's the pull on college campuses to these particular activist organizations?
So when I was in college, Antifa wasn't a huge group, but I think definitely this is a concern for this should be a concern for parents, because a lot of colleges, even if they're in some place like North Carolina, the college campuses are fairly liberal, pretty progressive. Of course, this isn't every college, but I know certainly University of Iowa could fall into that. And it's a concern, you know, what are these 18, 19-year-old kids really being taught?
Right. So is this emblematic of the fact that this is a bigger sort of far left swing in American higher education? Is this something that we need to be watching out for in the future, particularly because these are instructors, they are professors, individuals in authority who are aligning themselves with an anarchist, hard left, sometimes violent organization? Do we need to be mindful of this in the future with other colleges and universities?
I mean, I think it's fair to be mindful of it just because it's happened a few times in the past now, and as Antifa grows, it's not terribly out of the realm of possibility to assume that there would be more professors or people who are in, you know, places of power coming out showing their support for groups like this. So, yeah, I think that would be fair.
Shelby Talcott, a reporter with the Daily Signal, has been my guest today, talking about college professor resigning after admitting support for Antifa. It has been said that the left, really, as they find themselves more and more enraged by the successes and the burgeoning size and perhaps the bigness, the largesse of Donald Trump's personality as he fights, as he continues his ongoing discussions in a re-election bid, as we see GOP members indicating whether or not they will run, new candidates entering the race, we have every reason to believe that the rhetoric will amp up and not, in fact, become silent. So it's something that we will be watching for in the future. This has been Washington Watch. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Thanks for joining us today. I'll talk to you again tomorrow.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.